Today in the Srimad Bhagavatam class, we will be discussing from the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 2. Chapter 2 is called as the symptoms of Kali Yuga. And we will be discussing text 42.
Katham seyam makhandabhu पूर्वैर मे पुरुषैर धृता कथं सेयम् अखण्डाभू पूर्वैर मे पुरुषैर धृता मत्पुत्रस्य च पौत्रस्य मत्पूर्ववंशजस्य वा मत्पुत्रस्य च पौत्रस्य मत्पूर्वावंशजस्य वा कथम्
हौ स इयम् दिस् सेम् अखण्डा अन्बौण्डेड् भू अर्थ् पूर्वै बै द प्रिडेसेसर्स् मे माय पुरुषे by the person, sorry, by the personalities, dhrita, held in control, mat putrasya, of my son, cha, and pautrasya, of the grandson, mat purva, now under my sway, vamsajasya, of the descendant, va, or, translation. The materialistic king thinks this unbounded earth was held by my predecessors. The materialistic king thinks this unbounded earth was held by my predecessors and is now under my sovereignty. How can I arrange for it to remain in the hands of my sons, grandsons and other descendants? The materialistic king thinks this unbounded earth was held by my predecessors and is now under my sovereignty. How can I arrange for it to remain in the hands of my sons, my grandsons and my other descendants? It's a very small purport. The purport says, this is an example of foolish possessiveness. This is an example of foolish possessiveness. That's what the purport contains.
Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
टुडे वी फिनिश एट 8:30 सैटरडे दैट्स द गाइडलाइन Stresses me up. Alright. Right. So, the purport is a one-liner which says, this is an example of foolish possessiveness. So, I'll just go through the summary of this chapter. So, the context is clearly set of what this chapter is all about. We are actually at the fag end of this chapter. There are just probably a couple of more verses before we go into the next chapter. So the summary is as follows. This chapter, and I am reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, the actual summary written by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. This chapter relates that when the bad qualities of the age of Kali will increase to an intolerable level, the Supreme Personality of Godhead will descend as Kalki to destroy those who are fixed in irreligion. After that, a new Satya Yuga will begin. As the age of Kali progresses, all good qualities of men will diminish and all impure qualities will increase. Atheistic systems of so-called religion will become predominant, replacing the codes of Vedic law. The kings become just like highway bandits. The people in general become dedicated to low occupations. And all the social classes become just like Shudras. All cows become like goats. All spiritual hermitages become like materialistic homes. And family ties extend no further than the immediate relationship of marriage. When the age of Kali has almost ended, the Supreme Personality of Godhead will incarnate. He will appear in the village Sambhala, in the home of the exalted Brahmana Vishnuyasa, and will take the name Kalki. He will mount his horse Devadatta and, taking his sword in his hand, will roam about the earth killing millions of bandits in the guise of kings. Then the signs of the next Satya Yuga will begin to appear. When the moon, sun and the planet Brihaspati enter simultaneously into one constellation and conjoin in the lunar mansion Pushya, Satya Yuga will begin. In the order of Satya, Treta, Dwapar and Kali, the cycle of four ages rotates in the society of living entities in this universe. The chapter ends with a brief description of the future dynasties of the sun and moon. The chapter ends with a brief description of the future dynasties of the sun and moon coming from Vaivashvata Manu in the next Satya Yuga. Even now, two saintly Kshatriyas are living who at the end of this Kali Yuga will re-initiate the pious dynasties of the sun god Vivaswan and the moon god Chandra. One of these kings is Devapi, a brother of Maharaj Shantanu, and the other is Maru, a descendant of Ikshvaku. They are biding their time incognito. So these people are still there. It's mentioned in Bhagavatam that they are biding their time incognito in a village named Kalapa. Katham seyam akhandabhu purvairme purushayaduta mat putrasya cha pautrasya mat purva vam sadasya va. The materialistic king thinks this unbounded earth was held by my predecessors and now under my sovereignty. How can I arrange for it to remain in the hands of my grandsons, my sons, my descendants? So that's the translation. So this chapter, and you know, as is very evident from this verse as well, is primarily focused around the degradation of leadership in Kali Yuga. And the entire chapter talks quite a bit about the symptoms of the degradation of such leadership in society. Now it's a strange coincidence that we are discussing the ill effects of Kali Yuga at this time at Melbourne Mahaprabhu Mandir. So I was just wondering that, just last week we had the tsunami and we had the Japanese earthquake and all of us were watching those horrible videos, and even now people are stranded on the roads, children are there without food, they get one soup to drink in a day and that's it. Now I don't even know whether they are getting that. They are just wrapped in blankets under thick snow. So it's a very horrible existence, and we have the misfortune of witnessing all that. Also, just before that we had the Christchurch earthquake, and even our temple was affected by that. So all these things are happening. So the material world is being struck by one calamity after another. And here in the Srimad Bhagavatam class also, we are discussing the same, how Kali Yuga is going to degrade and eventually get destroyed piece by piece. So this is a good blend of Shruti and Pratyaksha Praman that we are having. So we are hearing on one hand, and then we go home and then we see those videos, then we know that yes, Srimad Bhagavatam, whatever it has predicted, is actually coming true for Kali Yuga. But Srila Prabhupada, as much as we say that it's a strange coincidence that this is happening, Srila Prabhupada said that there are no accidents or coincidences. Srila Prabhupada said everything happens by the desire of the Lord. So we will take it as the desire of Sri Sri Radha Vallabha that we are having a taste of both Srimad Bhagavatam theory in this classroom as well as practically observing what's happening to the world, and so that we may develop a healthy detachment for material life and we may
practice Krishna consciousness more vigorously to go home back to Godhead in this very lifetime. Otherwise, sometimes the resolute determination doesn't come and we actually don't see what Srimad Bhagavatam is predicting with our own eyes. It's said that experience is the best teacher, but the second line also says that fools only learn by this way out. So this purport has got only one line. It says, what does that purport say? It's all about foolish possessiveness. Now there is ample evidence of this foolish possessiveness in modern life. I was hearing a lecture on Amrut Manthan. It was being given by my godbrother Krishnanam Prabhu in Tripathi temple. You know what is Amrut Manthan? Amrut Manthan is the churning of the milk ocean. So where the asuras were on one side and the devatas were on one side, both of them were involved, you know, in intense fighting. Especially the asuras, they were saying that, okay, this belongs to me. And even amongst the asuras, every individual was saying, no, I should have the first share of the nectar. Even amongst the asuras, they were in fighting, not only between the asuras and the devas. So that is what was happening. So Srila Prabhupada gives interesting purports to that section, where he mentions that the symptoms of demons in Kali Yuga and the symptoms of demonic nature is that the demons are always in competition. They are always in this competitive mode. Okay. Always in competition as to who is the best in sense gratification. So this foolish possessiveness, the foolish possessiveness is the genesis of this competition. And this foolish possessiveness initially starts with the self. Aham mameti. Me and mine. Eventually, it starts extending to the family, then it starts extending to neighborhood, then society, and then so on and so forth, then to the country, like that. So the loyalties also keep changing. The definition of this foolish possessiveness also keeps evolving over a period of time for any individual. An example of how this foolish possessiveness, you know, exists between countries was seen in 2009, when we had the famous summit in Copenhagen in Denmark. Does anyone know what that summit was about? It was about global warming. It was the hottest issue in 2009. Even now it's a very hotly debated topic, very intensely debated topic. So in 2009, 193 countries from all over the world had assembled in Copenhagen in Denmark. What was the purpose, at least the original purpose, was to arrive at a common solution for global warming. This summit was such that 1 year in advance of this summit, people had already started preparing for these 12 days. It was lasting 12 days. From 1 year, preparations were on because big leaders from all over the countries were going to come. And people were very happy. They were hoping that yes, now all the big leaders are meeting. There will be some very nice policy changes, you know, because the top level leadership of all countries are meeting now. Now, why were people expecting these policy changes to happen? Just to give an example of Kali Yuga, it is mentioned that by 2050, which is hardly 39 years from now, by 2050 there will be major climatic changes. This is what is predicted. And it is said that because of these climatic changes, several countries will go underwater. Several countries. And 1 week back, nobody would have believed. Now people will believe, yes, it's possible that a country can go underwater, and just like that it can go. We saw how the helicopters, the Japanese people were announcing tsunami coming, and then we saw one by one, the houses are just plucked, lifted and then carried and kept at another place. And that too, you know, sometimes the houses are actually tumbled, yeah, upside down. Those $1 million houses for which, you know, we do a lot of auctions here and there. Those houses are just plucked and then they are tilted and kept on another side. That's all, finished. You can't even enter that house because it's upside down. So this is going to happen more often. This is just a specimen, that's all. It's just a sample. So by 2050, several countries are predicted to be underwater. And most of these countries, it is mentioned, especially the small islands, are at a high risk. You know, sometimes in the map you can't even see that. You have to really keep some, you know, lens or something and then see, oh, there are some countries here. So these countries definitely will be submerged. Now what the interesting point is, the leaders of these small countries were also present in Copenhagen, Denmark. Now you can imagine who is the most desperate for the solution, right? So these are the leaders. They say that, you know, our country will not exist, so our leadership anyway will not exist. Right? So, people were very desperate and praying that something happens in this Copenhagen convention. So, it's, in fact, it is said that what to speak of 2050, it is said that even now, even today, mankind is in a point of no return. Even if today we were to start taking corrective measures, we may probably not be able to do anything by 2050. So at least we may do something. So that is the kind of desperate situation we are in. So, this is the state of the world. In fact, it is mentioned that the air in many countries today is not even worth breathing. For example, in Bombay, recently I went for the South India Yatra with our spiritual master. And since I live in Bombay, I also visited my parents in Bombay. It's from worse, it's become horrible now. Bombay. There is a place in Bombay called as Chembur. I don't know if anyone of you know this place. This Chembur is mentioned as amongst the worst in the world in terms of pollution. Worst. It is probably the number, maybe top 10 places in the world. Okay. So, it's a very prestigious location to live in. It's there, it's featuring somewhere at least. So, it is said that person living in Chembur, even if he is a teetotaler, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he gets the impact of smoking 20 cigarettes per day just by inhaling the fumes which are there around us. So, you don't have to, you know, practice anything. Smoking is injurious to health, that's fine. But not smoking is also injurious to health. Breathing is injurious to health in these places. So, this is the state of affairs today. So, this Copenhagen convention, obviously all the powerful nations gathered. And which was the most powerful nation? And to who everyone looks for a solution? The United States of America. Now, records and statistics show who is the highest pollutant in the world, which country? United States of America. Right? That is the paradox here. Okay. So, it is mentioned that the ratio of cars to people, or rather people to cars, is 750 cars for every 1,000 people, which means virtually every single person owns a car. 75%, I mean, in one sense, 75% of the people at least are driving cars day in and day out. And if you compare it with the statistics of Asia, Asia is around 55 for every 1,000. So you can imagine, where is 750 and where is 55? Okay, and then US is supposed to give a solution. And it is mentioned that vehicular emissions are the biggest contributor. Vehicles which are going on the land, they are the biggest contributor. What to speak of vehicles, at a global level, the highest pollutant nowadays is considered to be aeroplanes. Aeroplanes, they release so much of jet fuel that they directly go to the ozone layer and finish it off. So that's the impact of aeroplanes. Statistics say that every day there are 250,000 flights that take off or land. 250,000 flights just taking off, landing. And you can imagine, and each aeroplane is continuously emitting so much of jet fuel into the atmosphere. In John F. Kennedy Airport, New York, every 30 seconds a flight is taking off or is landing. That's the kind of traffic we talk about. On top of that, we have the modern day factories which are spewing out industrial pollutants into the sea. If we thought that air was a problem, now we are coming to water. Right? Water is not spared. Not only water pollution, but the carbon monoxide which these factories release, because they burn coal for electricity and so on and so forth, that is also contributing to atmospheric pollution. Now coming to land, air is gone, water is gone. Now to land, that is also not spared. It is mentioned that every year 10,000 tons of nuclear waste is dumped into earth. Now, because nuclear waste contains radioactive substances, you can't keep it outside. So the great solution that mankind has come up with is to put this waste in various whatever tins, boxes, whatever you may call, and then push it down the earth and cover the earth with mud. Okay. Now that is obviously not going to solve the problem. A, because these radioactive elements, the radiation coming out cannot die within a few minutes or few days. It takes months, and most of the radioactive elements, it takes years for the radiation to go down. But they are taken and dumped inside the earth, so everyone forgets. After that, obviously nobody is going to dig the earth and then go and see what's happening. So it is assumed that everything will be alright. After that, it will die down and everything will be nice with the world. But we know from Srimad Bhagavatam that at the end of the day, everything is Mahatattva. Everything is going to merge into earth. So eventually, when it disintegrates, then all that radioactivity is going to get released into the land. Through that, it is again going to seep back into the waters. And you know what kind of water we are going to drink many years down the line. So that is the state of affairs. So it is said that all this is likely to impact our surroundings, weather as well as the climate. Now coming back to Copenhagen, now with all this seriousness, having got all this knowledge, the summit leaders had met for a solution. On one hand, we had all these small countries, tiny countries, who were completely bewildered. And on the other hand, we had these big countries who were supposed to advise them on a solution. Now what happened, what ended up there, was a big fight in this convention between the developed nations like the United States, Denmark, etc. and the big developing countries like China and India. There was a big fight amongst these countries. Out of the 12 days, it is mentioned that 11 days were spent only on fighting as to who should be the first person to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions. They said that US is the leading emitter and China has the second proud status of the second largest emitter. Okay, so the US and China should do it first. Now, US was on the developed side and China was on the developing side. There was a big fight. Now, why developed countries started clamoring for the developing ones to take emission targets. Now, the developed countries said that, no, you guys take up targets first and we will appoint, third-party agencies to monitor your pollution, who will visit your country from time to time. The developing countries said that, no, yet yet atarchi sheshas, whatever great men do, people will follow. So, you people are the great men of society and you yourself claim that. So, you people set an example with your leadership. You start inside your house and tell us how to reduce, CO2 emissions. So, this was a kind of, this was a theme of conversations which are happening. Of course, it was not so dignified as I am saying. It was at a different level. The participants were not ordinary people. Obviously, they were the heads of countries. And they had taken a full 12 days off from ruling their individual countries. Top class, dignitaries were there. Finally, on the 11th day, matters came to a standstill. There was only fighting. Nothing was happening. And the last day, who came in? The President of the United States of America. He came in to give a solution. When he came in, obviously he had no clue what to do. He is not a Paramahamsa or somebody. So he didn't have a clue. So he did something interesting. He came in and he said, hang on, let's not fight. I hereby declare billions of dollars, I think there was some $15 billion or $20 billion of aid to all you developing countries so that you can cope up with the climatic changes. That solved the whole problem. Can you imagine? That's all. That was the end of Copenhagen summit. That's all. Why? The developing countries are also not any Paramahams Babajis. The developing countries also, they said, okay, fine. With money power, you can buy us. With money power, you can buy our own rights in our own country. No problem. But give us the money. Right? So $15 billion, $20 billion. So they also succumbed to that. So the whole conference ended with no resolution and no one signing up for anything. So nobody responsible for anything, nothing has been drafted. And public's money, tax, it all, these conventions happen with our money, your money and my money, right? Krishna's money at the end of the day. Taxpayers' money goes and then they wasted time, had a good time and came out. The original objective of reducing carbon emission was completely forgotten. So this is a classic case in Kali Yuga where with money you can buy anything in this world. And that is what even this chapter, the whole theme was that. In Kali Yuga, with money power, that is what will speak at the end of the day. Whoever has money, his voice will be heard over others' voice. Now an example of corporate life. Now how Kali Yuga is coming into corporate life. An interesting example I heard. Corporate life was compared to a treadmill. Now, have you seen a treadmill? In the morning when we go to office sometimes, even when I go to, the Docklands office there, I see some transparent doors are there, people exercising vigorously in the morning, even at 9 o'clock, 9:30.
So the treadmill is an instrument where you stand and then, you know, there's a belt and then you press a button and then the belt starts moving and then you start jogging on the treadmill. You start running, running, running. Initially it's slow. Gradually what happens? The speed of the treadmill is increased, right? And again it's increased and increased until the time you are puffing and panting and then you are running. Now what happens is, slowly the angle of inclination of the treadmill is also increased. So the slope is increased. So further you are puffing and panting now. And you are running, 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 running. But at the end of the day, when the treadmill is switched off, where are you? You are in the same place where you started. Now this is corporate life. Promotions of corporate life. Right? So, it is mentioned that this corporate life nowadays is like a running on a treadmill. For the same money, to retain the same position, what to speak of promotions, to retain the same level of income, to retain the same level of standards that we have been living life, we have to work harder and harder. There is no respite. And it is mentioned that in few days, in fact, what to speak of, it's mentioned, you know, it's our own experience. Now we can speak from our corporate experience that few years back, you know, when at least my father was working, at least he used to leave office at 5 o'clock, 5:30, and then he used to come home and be with the family at the end of the day. So I knew that, you know, yeah, it's time for Papa to come home. But today our children don't know when Papa will come home, whether Papa will come home from office, right? So that is the state of affairs. When I was doing a project way back in somewhere in 1999, I was doing a project for one of India's, you know, big companies called Reliance. The culture in Reliance was nobody goes home. Okay, ever. So we were also sitting, we were consultants to them. So when the client is not going, obviously the consultants cannot go home. So every day I had to travel almost 30-32 kilometers. That's from one end of Bombay to the other end of Bombay in crowded, jam-packed, you know, local trains. Get down and then take a taxi further, that to a share taxi. Where, you know, 5 people or 6 people will be sitting. One on the lap of other. And then go till that particular office. Okay. For another 15-20 minutes, and then reach there, and if I happen to leave at 7:30, boss will raise an eyebrow from there. 7:30 in the night, if you leave office from there, he says, are you going half a day today? He'll ask you. This was the state of affairs. Right? I'll never forget those days. Horrible days. And you didn't get anything, you got the same salary, nothing. Nothing was happening. It was just that you go, come, and that's what is life. And on top of that, you are expected to work on Saturday. This is Indian corporate life. Why do you think we are in Australia? Because at least Saturdays you don't have to work here. Other things are the same. Right? So, this is the state of affairs in the corporate world. And this is the kind of leadership also we have. Which just makes you work harder and harder and harder. So, by the time even our salary goes up, even by working so hard, when the salaries goes up, taxes are already gone up. In fact, now they are proposing a new tax. They are saying that, you know, every individual in the country will be monitored for his carbon emissions or whatever, for his contribution to polluting the atmosphere, and there will be a tax on that. So we have to be very careful about our cars, we have to be careful about our ovens and so on and so on, our dryers. Everything will come as a big fat bill back to us. In one sense it's good, but by doing all this, we are only attacking the symptoms of the problem. And that's the whole import of whatever we are discussing. And even if you manage to make some money, inflation takes control of you. For example, we all know how the property prices in Melbourne have been growing up, you know, from year to year. The house which was available few years back for 250,000, now is not available for less than 550,000. Right? So, virtually, you know, houses are becoming unaffordable for the common man. And the leadership is just taking a silent view of this. In fact, when the whole world was under the global recession, it is mentioned that Melbourne property prices were still going up. Normally in a recessionary economy, the property prices are supposed to go down. But in Melbourne, it was quite the opposite trend. Now how that happened was because government was pumping lot of funds. Now they started developing a very artificial solution to that by giving everyone some grant of some $25,000. Okay, go and buy. In fact, they also gave people, the citizens, some $1,000, was it? Go and spend. $900? Yeah, go and spend. Pardon? $900. Some stimulus and this and that. So at the end of the day, Governments only want the people to work harder and harder and to keep spending money. So that is the kind of leadership today we see even at the corporate level. Coming to legislation, even the laws today are amended to, I mean, it's the laws are becoming crazier and crazier. In fact, you know, when I came to Australia first time in 2005, when I was filling my tax return form, I was bewildered to see a question: has she been your spouse for the entire financial year? No, we didn't know. In Vedic culture, when a husband and wife marry, then it is said janam janam ka saath, which means in several lifetimes, you know, we will never let, you know, till death do us apart. You know, that was the kind of vows. That is Vedic culture in marriage. And here we are talking about spouse for the financial year. Okay. So that is the degradation of laws. So laws are manifesting even in those forms which we fill. And recently, because we purchased a house, and I was talking to some solicitor, you know, to do the transfer of property. So the solicitor gave us a big document. And he said, there were several clauses in that document. But he said, if you don't answer any of this, at least one clause is there which you should answer. And he said, urgent, very, very urgent. I said, what is this urgent thing? So I looked at it, and it is said that, are you going to be living in this house with your partner or spouse? So please tell us very upfront, what is the percentage share which, you know, she will have, which I will have. Already it is a small house, it's a two bedroom. On top of that, what share will she have, what share will I have in that house? Okay, and this is completely unheard of. In fact, in Vedic culture, and even to a large extent it's prevalent in India today, you never say, it's my father's house. Normally we don't say like that. Where do you live? I live here. It's assumed that your father is living with you, it's your mother is living with you, your sisters are living with you until they are married, right? And assume that brothers are living together. This is Vedic culture, and this is still prevalent in India to a large extent. Of course, it's breaking up now. So, but this was very, you know, this was a very tricky question. So he has given some few options there which I have to take. Whether she will be joint partner, or whether she will be this kind of partner or that kind of partner. I didn't understand the question. And then I asked him, you know, I don't understand this form. He said, no problem, I'll explain it to you. My fees are $1,000. So then I just gave up. I said, no, I don't want to deal with you. So I'm looking for another solicitor. If any of you know, please tell me. Okay. So this is Kali Yuga. This is Kali Yuga. This is leadership. This is policy making. Welcome to it. And we are living day in and day out in this absolute mess which has been created. Okay. So whatever Srimad Bhagavatam is saying, we can see it happening in our day-to-day life. So in one sense, this chapter is the best praman. If somebody reads this canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, he will automatically develop faith in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. So first read the 12th canto, then come back. Of course, that's not Prabhupada's recommendation. Prabhupada's recommendation was to read from the first canto onwards, so we should follow that, but I'm just giving it from a different angle. So, if we compare now the leadership of today to the rule, the leadership of yesteryears, the leaders at that time were very self-realized. The core difference is, the leaders who were there in the earlier ages, they used to follow Brahminical advice. Varanashrama Dharma was strictly followed during those days. So there were Brahmanas, there were Kshatriyas, there were Vaishyas, there were Shudras. Kshatriyas always used to be kings. Brahmanas never used to take the job of a king. In fact, even once Srila Prabhupada was asked by some press reporter, Srila Prabhupada, no, you are now the, look at all these people, they are bowing down at you. Right? So Srila Prabhupada said, yeah, they are bowing down at me, but I am just their servant. There is nothing else. I am just a servant. They are serving me and they are assisting me in serving the Lord. So Srila Prabhupada never took any kind of an authoritative position. But the leaders of today, they are completely of the idea that they are completely besotted with the idea of ownership. The idea of ownership extends at the individual level, as we mentioned before, and gradually it extends out to society, nation and so on and so forth, community and so on and so forth. Now, they are so besotted with themselves that the leaders today don't even bother to take advice, feedback from the community which they serve. And there was an interesting point that I heard in this regard, that when Lord Ram was leading the world at that time, when Lord himself had manifested, he was Maryada Purushottam. He came to epitomize what is ideal leadership. We all know that his consort Sita, she was put to the Agni Pariksha, to the fire, the test of fire, simply because of a feedback which was given by one of the citizens. So that was the power of a feedback from society. So I heard in one of the classes that today also corporates take feedback from customers, but the objective is not welfare. The objective is the customer's wallet, not the welfare of the customer. Today also feedback is taken. We do a lot of customer service. Are you happy with our product? Do you have any problems, sir? We can replace it for you. But that's not out of concern. At the end of the day, the only goal is that how can the company make more and more money. So even feedback has lost its relevance in today's society. There is no integrity to seeking feedback. So leadership, in short, has become completely exploitative and self-centered. And all these leaders, modern day leaders, they want to rule forever. In fact, it was mentioned that Maharaj Uttanapad, when we think of Maharaj Uttanapad, generally sometimes we may get some negative opinion about him, simply because, Dhruva Maharaj walked out, he could not sit on his lap, therefore he had to go out and eventually come back, and we know the whole pastime of Dhruva Maharaj. But it is mentioned in the scriptures that Maharaj Uttanapad was actually not an ordinary selfish person. It just happened, it was a leela of the Lord, but he was a king who was highly self-realized. And towards the end, when Dhruva Maharaj became qualified to rule the kingdom, when he eventually came back, Maharaj Uttanapad immediately consulted his superiors and stated Dhruva Maharaj on the throne and left his kingdom at the right time. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, if we read, there are so many kings who have demonstrated these values, where when the time has come, they have left their positions. But again, in modern day society, we find that the leaders do everything and anything to cling on to their chairs. So there is a stark contrast between the leadership of then and the leadership of now. So, because these kings like Maharaj Uttanapad lived their lives in that manner, they in fact passed the ultimate test of what a king should pass, which means they proved that I never had any personal agenda in ruling, but my agenda was always the welfare of the citizens, and when I came to know that I could not serve in that capacity with the same effectiveness, then I am leaving that throne. So Srila Prabhupada said, what is the remedy for this, for leadership of modern society? Srila Prabhupada said that if in the present day people are Krishna conscious, then the leaders will automatically become Krishna consciousness. So the Prabhupada said that the onus rests actually with all of us. If we all become Krishna conscious, then slowly and spread Krishna consciousness in society, only then society will have the knowledge of who to vote for and who not to vote for. Right? Otherwise, Srila Prabhupada said only rascals will be voted in society. Okay. Why? Because people in general do not know what they want. They think that happiness lies in acquiring material assets. For example, in India, it's not uncommon. For example, there's a party in South India called DMK. Okay. Now the DMK chief minister, when the opposition party guy who eventually wanted to rule South India, this guy wanted to become chief minister, he announced free television sets for everybody in the villages. So thousands and thousands were of television, lakhs of televisions were produced and given. Now obviously, what he ensured was that, he got enough of money from the companies which were manufacturing these televisions. So he got a cut of their revenue also, on top of that. And then these televisions were given to all the villages. So villagers thought that, oh, here is, the chief of, DMK party. He is the one who is really, concerned about our welfare. Because the wife must have been nagging the husband. We don't have a television set at home. And then when the television set actually comes, then everyone's material dreams are fulfilled. And therefore they'll go and vote for that particular party. So that is how the political parties, the leadership is also exploiting the masses today. It is also mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam that in Vedic society, the leaders were actually respected and honored for their selflessness. But in Canto 2, Srimad Bhagavatam itself says that as Kali Yuga progresses, leaders who will demonstrate qualities as that of horses, asses and camels will be praised. So, the point that we are saying is the praja or the subjects in society are as much responsible for as much as the leaders of society. Because the consciousness of the subjects will be reflected in the consciousness of the leaders. The attitude of the subjects will manifest in the attitude of the leaders. If we want to be exploited, then Krishna will send somebody who will go on exploiting us. So I was hearing a lecture, and I'll end with that. I was hearing a lecture which His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj was giving to the students of the University of Columbia. Now, as all of you know, University of Columbia is among the top class universities in the world, which produces the next generation leaders in corporate life and in society. So he was addressing all these people, and the whole theme, what he was speaking was, leadership means servant leadership, not master leadership. The person who is the best servant is the person who is qualified to be the leader of society. So he said some interesting points which I have just noted down, I'll share with all of you. He says that Columbia University is among the best of the universities. It's a highly prestigious place to study in, and obviously this university will equip all of you with knowledge, with influence, with wealth, prestige and strength. But he said, along with all these things comes a very, very great responsibility, that of encouraging morality, virtue, character and pursuit of real happiness. So he mentioned that it is the onus of the leaders to show society what is the real pursuit of what is the pursuit to real happiness. He said that real happiness is in short supply in today's world, and virtues, morality, character, etc. have no utilitarian value in today's society. They don't help anyone in making more money. And the definition of happiness is simply in accumulation of more and more wealth. Of course, Maharaj, he was also commending some of the good leaders in society, at least who have woken up. He gave the example of Xerox. Now, Xerox is a world class organization. Everyone knows what Xerox company manufactures. It manufactures those Xerox machines, which are, the machine itself has become synonymous with their name. So it is mentioned that originally when the Xerox machines were made, they were not conducive to the environment. So once, it seems that the management team went to a touring somewhere in a village, they went on some excursion or somewhere, and they saw the impact that their machines are having on the common man. They saw how these machines are polluting the environment. But because they had some very thoughtful leaders, they came back, they changed the complete policies of the company, and today whatever machines that they manufacture are degradable, which means they don't pollute the environment. So Maharaj was commending that this is obviously he's speaking to Columbia University students, so he can't directly say that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and so on and so forth. So he's trying to, bring them, from a different angle. So he said, so at least the first step is to realize that it's the responsibility of the leadership to take some steps to protecting the environment. He said that powerful leaders will always be vested with the power of choice. So it's very important that knowledge of how to use that choice for the benefit of mankind, it's very important that these leaders have that knowledge with them. Leaders have to have knowledge of where lies true happiness. He said, unfortunately, the best institutions in the world do not really focus on this. And the common understanding in society is that a human being at the end of the day is nothing but a sum total of his desires. So that's the definition of a human being. And happiness comes in fulfillment of those desires thereafter. This is what everyone thinks. He made an interesting statement. He says, the truth actually is something different. And this line really appealed to me. He said, it is not that life is to desire. He said, it is not that life is meant to desire, but rather that desire is the main cause of material life. So the cause and effect has to be reversed. I'll repeat this. It is not that life is to desire, rather desires are the cause of material life. So what we are actually seeking through life, he said, is genuine love from within the heart. We think that we are seeking happiness through matter, but internally what we are seeking is genuine love of the heart. In fact, in the Journey Home book which he has written, there is an experience where he goes and meets Mother Teresa. Some of you who have read the book may be aware. So when he met Mother Teresa, Mother Teresa had just won the Nobel Prize, just I think the previous year or something like that. Now, Mother Teresa had no... And when Maharaj met her, she was actually completely black, you know, with soot, because she was inside washing pots. Just imagine, Nobel Prize winner, you know, washing pots. So Maharaj went and spoke to her, and she told him that I have realized in my life that the real happiness is in serving mankind. And that's what she was very famous for. But she said another thing. She said that the greatest problem in this world is hunger, but not hunger of the belly. The biggest problem in the world is hunger of the heart, she said. And she said that the only thing that can feed nourishment to this hungry heart is love for God. So to give that love for God in today's world, especially to the masses as well as to the leadership, is the greatest challenge which anyone can have in society. She mentioned that when the poverty-stricken beggars at Calcutta, because she was based out of Calcutta, so several beggars used to come to her ashram. So she said that when these poverty-stricken beggars of Calcutta, they die in my arms, I can see a light in all their eyes at the time of death. I can see that they are at peace with themselves. But I never saw that light in the eyes of aristocratic people of the West who have seen dying. So this is what she mentioned. So Maharaj quoted several points, and he said, in fact he also quoted his experience with a leading cricketer in India. When he landed at a particular airport, cricket, you know how popular in India is. Cricket is like, you know, next to godliness. Yeah, it's the best religion. It's the topmost religion nowadays in India. If you speak cricket, everyone listens to you. So it's like that. So when he had got down at the airport, he met one leading cricketer. I believe it was Sourav Ganguly, the captain of the Indian team, who he had met. And because then eventually now, you know, Sourav Ganguly, the captain of the Indian cricket team, he has also read The Journey Home, and he has actually commented on the website. That's actually the biggest advertisement for Journey Home, in one sense. So, when he met this cricketer, he asked, as this cricketer was walking along, he was, you know, extremely sad and morose. And throughout the flight, people observed that he was not raising his hands and looking at everyone. He was just looking straight, neither looking here nor there, or sometimes peeping out the window. And he was very sad. So, when he was walking along, Maharaj walked up to him and asked him, "You look very sad. Can I help you in any way?" And nobody had ever asked him that question, because all the time people only used to go to him for autographs or to click a photograph with him, because they wanted to increase their own prestige. You know, from, you know, it's like borrowed plumes. He's a prestigious personality. I don't have anything worth respecting me for. So let me stand and take a photograph with him and then put it in my house, so people will respect me therefore. You know, that is the consciousness, you know, of associating with these men. But Maharaj walked up to him and said, "You look very sad. Can I do something for you to help you?" So when he said that, he was completely moved. He said, yes, actually I'm miserable, he said. I'm miserable. All the time I'm being noticed by the country. All the time media attention is on me. And at that time he was at the peak. He was the captain of the Indian cricket team. All media attention is on me all the time. I can't do anything without being noticed. So it's a miserable existence. And whatever I do, the media captures that and puts it in the newspapers. Okay? And what to speak of that? If at all I do something wrong, I don't even have a right to do something wrong, because then everyone follows whatever I am doing. And then that becomes the standard in society. So Maharaj then spoke to him eventually, and finally somewhere his heart changed. And actually he became very receptive to the devotees, and now he is actually reading Bhagavad Gita, he has read the, you know, Journey Home, and I heard from some of my god brothers that he is turning around very nicely towards, you know, Krishna consciousness. In fact, the only cricketer that I have heard of. So here Maharaj, essentially the point that he is driving to these Columbia University lecturers with this example was that we have to develop that purity by which we can influence the thinking of such powerful people in society. Because unless we have the purity, we can't influence thinking of such people in society. And if we don't influence such people in society, then we can't influence the larger masses. And he gave an example. He said, next day after I met this cricketer, I was giving Srimad Bhagavatam class. Normally, there is a big group which plays cricket outside the temple. They never come for any lecture. But some brahmachari went and told them that Maharaj met Sourav Ganguly yesterday, you know, and he has become friends. So there was full 100% attendance, 120% attendance in the class. Maharaj said, "My credibility was that I am a friend of that cricketer." So that is how. But then again, we can use that in influencing the masses. That was the point that he was driving. So he said that spiritual leadership, he concluded the class by saying spiritual leadership is not based on exploitation but based on actual humility. Any leadership which tries to exploit the masses will never stand the test of time. He quoted the example of King Louis XIV in Versailles. Am I pronouncing it right? I don't know. Versailles, right? So he had a queen called as Mary. Now, King Louis, he had immense wealth and opulence, but he always tried to use that opulence to show off to people. So he used to call big noblemen, he used to call big people just to show off his wealth. Now when we use that wealth to only show off, people are going to be associating with us all the time, obviously because we have that wealth, but people are going to be associating with us in the wrong mood, in the mood of envy. Eventually, people who he invited, who came to his palace, they were the cause of his ruin. They put up big propaganda against these people, and eventually to supplement that, the queen also was no good. The queen never knew the pulse of the society. In fact, when the subjects were starving at that time, the famous dialogue is there, in the history, where the people go and ask the queen, please give us some bread. She says that if you don't have bread, why don't you eat cake? So that's the reply she gave. And what happened to them afterwards? Their subjects came and beheaded. Both the king and the queen were beheaded. So Maharaj said that if you have this kind of exploitative mentality towards your subjects, then that leadership will not stand the test of time. And this is what will happen. And he contrasted that immediately with the spiritual leadership which is provided by Srila Prabhupada. When Srila Prabhupada went to the West, he had nothing in his pocket, which all of us know. But when he went there, he took the position of a servant of those people who he wanted to preach to. So, because he took that position of servant leadership, Srila Prabhupada succeeded in his leadership despite all cultural differences that were existing at that time. In fact, at that time it was mentioned that don't trust anyone who is above 30 years of age. And Prabhupada was more than double that age, and Prabhupada succeeded in bringing them to Krishna consciousness. So, this is because Srila Prabhupada's mood was that the only thing that belongs to me, Srila Prabhupada said, the only thing that belongs to me is my service to you. That's all. And that was his mood towards the end. Even when Srila Prabhupada received lot of opulences from George Harrison and from John Lennon of the Beatles, even amidst all that opulence, Srila Prabhupada never forgot that his mission is to serve these people and make them Krishna conscious. So that never changed for Srila Prabhupada. So that is the mood. If the leadership of modern day imbibes, then we will have a prosperous world. Otherwise, the problems which are mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam in Kali Yuga, those will continue and get worser and worser. So I'll stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Alright. Yeah, sorry. I have not read much on Maharaj Janak, but I heard in a recent lecture that even great, highly realized spiritual personalities also used to be sent to Maharaj Janak for his advice. But some of the points which I can remember, that Maharaj Janak was an authority in scriptural knowledge. So, and not only was he an authority in theory, but even in his life he used to practice what he used to preach and what he has read. And so in one sense, the short answer to that is that because he was a pure devotee, he had all the credentials for being a global leader in one sense. So otherwise, if anyone else wants to throw some light, then happy. Anyone else who knows a little bit more of Maharajana? Gopanishwar, you?
Anything? He had all the 26 qualities of Vaishnava.
He had all the 26 qualities of Vaishnava. Okay.
Give an example of Prabhupada's leadership. He was a servant. feels the desire for the spiritual master, is very determined to say, how can we also maintain the same determination or close enough to feel spiritual masters?
You're asking me about which is beyond my realization. But I'll attempt to answer from whatever I have heard from the authorities. In fact, Kesha Prabhu is our Bhagavatam teacher, so I'll quote him, whatever he keeps on telling us in the class. He says that the resolute determination for serving our spiritual master, time and again he has mentioned this in the class, will not come unless and until we simplify our lives. For example, you know, being a grihastha, you know, grihasthas are subjected to the outside world. We have to go in day in, day out. We have to go and work. We are meeting outside people all the time. You know, most of the time we spend at workplace. So for a person like me, the instruction which he has given is, I have to have a strong sadhana in the morning at home. And also not only in the morning, even in the evening, regularly reading Srimad Bhagavatam, being, you know, with the family, being constantly in touch with Srimad Bhagavatam and simplifying my life, not just reading Srimad Bhagavatam and vomiting in the, you know, papers, but trying to, you know, constantly, this should be a constant effort. Every day, we must ask ourselves this question, how can I simplify my life? Because if we don't simplify our life, if we take on more and more and more of material responsibilities, then time is only 24 hours in a day, out of which, you know, 6 to 8 hours goes in sleeping, and then, you know, at least, you know, 3 or 4 more hours goes in, you know, attending to familial responsibilities, and then you have office for 8 hours. That leaves pretty much less time. And even if in that less time, if we are just running around here and there, increasing our material responsibilities, then we will not have any time to serve our spiritual master. Right. In one sense, we may be obeying the instructions of spiritual master, but that's not enough. I mean, just following the four regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds a day, that's bare minimum. But if we have to have the time to be able to execute, you know, projects which come from the vision of the spiritual master, then at the end of the day, the practical reality say that we should have time for that. If we don't have time, then, you know, we can't. For example, when we took a vow at the time of our initiation, in addition to, you know, 16 rounds and 4 regulative principles, now many Maharajas also say that in Ekadashi you should chant 25 rounds. We have seen Vedvyas Priya Maharaj giving that kind of instructions, for example. So the instruction which I got was that, you know, you should chant 16 rounds, follow the 4 regulative principles, and take a vow that you will assist me in spreading Srila Prabhupada's mission. Now that's a vow which, you know, was taken. Now, if I have to follow that instruction, then unless I simplify my own life and generate time out of that, then there is no way then I can, you know, contribute to, you know, any preaching activity like that. So the instruction of Kesha Prabhu is very significant here, that simplify our life. Have a good sadhana and keep life as simple as possible. Don't increase material necessities. And that material necessities need not be necessarily at a gross level. Material necessity generally doesn't only mean, you know, house, car, bungalow or whatever. Material necessities also is necessities of the subtle body, which means desire for recognition, desire for prestige. Sometimes those can take over. Sometimes externally, we may not have all those possessions, house, bungalow, everything. But internally, because we are not having all that, our mind will be thinking, seeking respect all the time. Seeking respect out of, you know, our own simplicity. Like being very proud of our humility, being very proud of not possessing anything. So the mind is very tricky. So both at the gross level and the subtle level, we have to ensure that, you know, time is not taken away by the demands of the mind. And obviously, you know, from Srimad Bhagavatam we understand that the only way to control the mind is Sevanam Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchate. So by engaging the mind in serving, I don't know whether I answered you or not, but what I heard from that, I'm also struggling to follow that. Okay, Shrimad Bhagavatam ki Shila Prabhupada Jai Nitai Gaur Prema.